Our study today is going to be the last part of chapter 4 of the book of Genesis. And this is the first time in our little mini-series that we've gotten into a genealogy. Genesis is known for its begats, you know, all its genealogies. We had a little of that, you know. Adam knew his wife Eve, and then they had the children, Cain and Abel. But now we actually get into a listing. Now, you may not, to begin with, find this as interesting as these famous narratives that we've had about the seven creation masterpieces, or about the Garden of Eden, or about Cain and Abel. On the other hand, if you give it a bit more attention than it's usually given, it will tell you some other things about humans that in some ways are also essential for understanding who we are. Because that's really what Genesis is telling. I therefore entitled this session as a kind of a primer about the cultural achievements of the creators, co-creators. In other words, God has co-creators. Remember when he said in Genesis 1, 26, 27, 28, that he was going to create man in his own image? He said that humans would be his, what shall we say, representatives on earth. They would multiply, fill the earth, have dominion over it. And this is not only with the natural growth, the growth that we have, I'll say, from the ground, from animals, from humans, the natural growth and creation, but from human accomplishments. Today we call that, I suppose, in its most sophisticated things, technology. A lot of people are against technology, and maybe it's out of hand. But I'm amazed here that in this part of Genesis, and I'm still amazed every time I study it, that we also have a genealogy of cultural achievements. Now, instead of asking you to read, I'm going to read for the simple reason that there are so many names here, and there are all these Hebrew names that it might embarrass a lot of people, and also to save time. So let's first of all just kind of hear what you have in chapter 4, verse 17 to the end. Really only 10 verses. Cain knew his wife, and she conceived and bore Enoch. And he built a city, and called the name of the city after the name of his son Enoch. To Enoch was born Irad, and Irad was the father of Mahuyael, and Mahuyael was the father of Methushael, and Methushael was the father of Lamech. And Lamech took two wives. The name of the one was Adah, and the name of the other Zillah. Adah bore Jabal. He was the father of those who dwell in tents and have cattle. And his brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of those who play the lyre and the pipe. Zillah bore Tubal-Cain. He was the forager of all instruments of bronze and iron. The sister of Tubal-Cain was Naamah. Lamech said to his wives, Adah and Zillah, hear my voice. You wives of Laman, hearken to what I say. I have slain a man for wounding me, a young man for striking me. If Cain is avenged sevenfold, truly Lamech 77-fold. And Adam knew his wife again, and she bore a son, and called his name Seth. For she said, God has appointed for me another child instead of Abel, for Cain slew him. To Seth also a son was born, and he called his name Enosh. At that time men began to call upon the name of the Lord. So far,
the text.
Now I have to preach. No, we're going to discuss. In some ways, this is not the sort of thing that you have in a narrative where you've got the scene set and then there's some tension and then you come to a turning point, a climax, and then the thing is solved. It's rather awkward, isn't it? It's hard to get your hands on it. Unless you find out that what you have here is listing, actually two listings. First, of seven of the descendants of Adam to the seventh one, Lamech. And then, to know that you're at the end of a genealogy, it usually has splitting into three parts, a kind of a trifurcation, if you want to call it that way. To his descendants, Jabal, Jubal, Tubal, Cain. Isn't that nice? It's almost like a poetry, and even though you don't know Hebrew, you can understand that. And even us who know Hebrew, it doesn't mean any more than it was to you. That's their name, Jabal, Jubal, Tubal, Cain. And you know you're at the end of that part. But then you start all over again. You wonder, what's happening now? You've got Adam, Seth, and Enosh. So that all together you have how many in these lists? 10. Well, now we've had 7 and we've had 10. Where did we have 7 once before?
7 days.
The 7 wonders of creation, you remember that? And I said, well, there are two ways of explaining why 7 is, someone called it God's number. Some people felt that the most important stars in the heavens, this is very ancient, before the Israelites, the Babylonians, they knew that there are certain stars that are fixed, you know, on the dome of heaven. They kind of move, but they're pretty well fixed on the dome. But there are 7, we call them planets, wandering stars. And didn't they call, we still have it in our calendar, we call the days of a week according to Sunday, Moon Day. Then you had other days. Well, we have the days of the old German gods. Tuesday, Wednesday, Wodansday, Torsday, Thursday, Tor, you know, the old god of lightning, and Freya, the goddess of fertility. And then we have Saturn Day, don't we? You know, Saturn, Saturday. Well, that's where some people say we got the sevens, and that's why it was important to them. They had things in sevens. I gave you another explanation. Well, let's take this book here. I don't know, it's one object. Ordinary, any object has six dimensions. You have the front and the back and the top and the bottom and this side and that side. And it's limited by that. But the seventh dimension transcends it. That's why it's transcendent, God's number. In fact, you have it here. This is very interesting that you have... The Lord said, if anybody touches my protege Cain, you know, he had his mark on him, remember that tattoo? I'll avenge him sevenfold. That's God's number, do you see that? He's God's protege. And here, what Lamech says, well, I got a sword. And anybody touches me, I'll do what I did to that rival. I kill him, and if anybody touches me, I'll avenge myself 70 times 7, you see that? Almost unlimited amount of time. You see that? Well, you can take your choice on 7, but that's the way this is built up. 7. Well, then you finally have 3 more. What's with 10? Why do we have? Why is the decimal system become so important in our society? For all our mathematics, it doesn't have to be. The ancients had a sexagesimal system. They had the basic number was 60. And by the way, 60 is much more flexible than our decimal system, because if you take 60 and you try to multiply without a remainder all kinds of numbers in it, you can multiply 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 12, 20, 15, you can multiply 30, and you've got 60. It's tremendous, it's very flexible. We still have our watches, isn't it? 60 minutes and all that, and 60 degrees of the compass and so forth. Well, does anybody know what's with 10? Let's come to 10. I'm talking about numbers, but they're all right here.
I hate to call you a shoulder, Ralph, but what about Naaman?
Pardon?
What about Naaman? Didn't she count in it?
Oh, yeah, but she's not an ancestor. She's just, I can put her down there, and I'll talk about her, too. I think she's, Ada means the painted one. No, but no, that's right. Yeah, the women didn't count in this society. She's not an ancestor. It's all through the men. I'm sorry. And it's a male chauvinist word, begat. You know what I mean? They have weasel words here, was the father. But it's really, is the father. You see that? And you have Ada, who's the painted one, and Scylla, who's the tinkling one. She has rings on her fingers and bells on her toes, and there's music wherever she goes. I hate to say it, but I will anyway. I think she's a red light district girl, a hooker. Maybe not, maybe not. I don't know. And Naaman means beautiful too. Get the idea? We call that SA, sex appeal. I'm sorry about that, but you asked for it. But they're not the main ones.
I'm talking about wives, I'm talking about children.
Yeah. Well, okay, and these are the children are known for that too. Do you see that? The problem is, if you start that way, and you can do that, you can even take each one of the names here and say, what does it mean in Hebrew? For instance, Methuselah means, there are various ways. When he dies, God will send it. He's going to send the flood. You can do all these etymologies. See that? The Bible actually doesn't do it itself. Do you see that? And just like my name, I don't know, Raphael, Ralph must come from Raphael, God heals, you see that? But ordinarily, that's not important for my name, you know, after one of the archangels. So you don't have to get everything out of the etymology, that's what I'm saying. But I think here these words are in phrases, phrases are in sentences, sentences are in larger units. And if you take the large unit, that's what I'm trying to get at. The structure here is two genealogies, the first one in sevens, and their descendants aren't counted in the ancestors, you see that. And they're mentioned, but more or less to give flavor to them. Let's call this a genealogy with notes. At certain points here, it will say, well, you notice that. Where did it say that there were certain firsts? Well, Cain was the tiller of the ground, wasn't he? Enoch built a city. Jabal was the father of those that have what? Cattle. He's got a Texas ranch. Not only a Texas ranch, but like those rich Texans, what else does he have? He controls all the slaughterhouses and all the restaurants and half of Wall Street. And an international cartel. I'm teasing you now, but that's one way to get it out. He's the first, though, the father of it. And Jabal is the first of those that, see this, what type of music is this? A harp, a flute, and a lyre. And music, this is nomadic life here, because if you're a nomad, can you carry a piano around? Maybe not even a guitar. So what do you have? You have a flute, or you have a stringed instrument, a lyre, maybe a drum. By the way, that may seem to us rather primitive, but I was in Ethiopia once, and I went to the German cultural school. They had a school there, and I heard a lecture on African music by a man who did a lot of work on it, and he showed the intricacy of just a simple flute melody. Well, we heard that last night, and it's very intricate. And then the drums and all the beating, it's tremendously sophisticated, and they understand that a lot more. So it may seem odd to us, but these are cultural firsts, you see that? Things that are first found. He's the father of that. And then you have here, Tubal-Cain is the one who starts what? Metallurgy, or what we call a forger, an artificer in bronze and iron. To take the kind of the rock, or if you want to say the stone that has the ore in it, and to work with this. Well, let's take a little background of this. Another thing I learned in my travels when I was in Africa is I was in Zululand on a tour, and they took us to one of these kraals of the natives. And one of the things that they showed us, I'll never forget, was a primitive blacksmith that had bellows. And they told a story about those bellows that they would use for making iron. One was male and the other one was female. And you had to do this, and to have this understanding, you had to tell this old story. And they understood metallurgy in connection with their religion. Well, some of you know this too. In Greek mythology, fire is not a human invention like these things are human achievements. Does anybody know where fire came from according to the Greeks? Well,
some
Prometheus. Pardon?
Some god or other.
Yes. Yeah. There was always, well, it's would be Hephaestus especially. He's the blacksmith, you know. And Prometheus kind of stole it. You remember that? It was a monopoly of the gods. And he stole it and gave it to his proteges, to the people on earth, and then they had fire. Most cultural achievements, therefore, in the ancient world in which ancient Israel is telling these stories, were achievements of the gods. The Sumerians have the most ancient of these stories that is attested to us. Let's say, for instance, if you have such a thing as a plow, that was invented by one of the gods and given to men who would use it on the gods' estate, that's in a temple. And it's all an achievement of divine people. But here, in this story, it's humans. God has given humans this capacity to be co-creators. Let me state it even a little stronger so you get the implication. Our life in this world, our human life, is not dependent merely on what grows in creation from God's good earth or from the animals, you see that, or from our own human procreation, but also is dependent upon the cultural things that we make. We're becoming very highly technologized in our world. And this is part of our human environment. And Genesis, I'm amazed here, goes back here. Once it's laid the foundations, we have that in chapters 2 and 3, what is human, and life of humans with humans. That was the first part of chapter 4. Now we have, I'd call this a primer about the cultural achievements. And I would include this, not only the discovery of things like DNA, and our ability now may perhaps to do human engineering, but from computer chips to nuclear fission or whatever you want to call it. And these shape our lives. They're shaping them all the more, aren't they? And so when these things are listed here, let's say them again. You don't just have nomads who are following flocks according to the season. They actually settle down with grain. They put in crops. They're farmers, agriculture. You see that? Cain is the first there. Then for settled life, you'll also have to have urban society. That's Enoch. And then you have the nomadic life, the animal husbandry that you have in Jabal. Then you have, and I think this is part of being human, music is just part of that in the culture and the arts, and this goes from all music, from folk music, hard rock to symphonies, and all this. This is a human achievement. And is there anything wrong with that?
No.
And even metallurgy, that you take the raw ore and that you create something new with it. There's not necessarily anything wrong with that. In fact, it can be a good thing. You can make swords out of it, and we have this song here of Lamech, who does what with his sword? It's usually called the sword song. Kills a rival, isn't it? Well, we'll talk about that in detail in a minute. But you can also do with metallurgy, you can take armaments and swords and you can put them into plowshares. And remember, for the Bible, that's the final thing, you see that? And so I would suggest that first of all, if you come to a very difficult section like this, take it for what it is, a listing. A listing in this case of not, like we'll have in chapter 5, descendants in a family that grows, the family of Adam. Just put it down here. We'll talk about that next time. From Adam to Seth to Enosh to Kenan to Mahalalel, Jared, Enoch, Methuselah, Lamech to Noah. And then in chapter 11, from Noah's son Shem all the way to Abram. You see that? In fact, as long as we're looking at this here, I don't know if you can see that there, but here I put the book of Genesis. The whole thing starts off, now, these are the generations of the heaven and the earth in the day that the Lord God made them. This is chapter 2, verse 4b. Then you have the generations of Adam all the way through to Noah. And then he has three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Notice just the way this divided up into Jabel, Jubal, Tubal, Cain. At the end you have Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And then peoples and peoples and peoples. I'll discuss that tomorrow. All kinds of them. 70. Some count 72 peoples listed in the whole list there. Very interesting. Then out of those peoples, from the still line of Shem, you will finally come to Abram, the father of the chosen people. And then you'll have Isaac, generations of Isaac, generations of Jacob. And you remember after he wrestled with God and beat God, he changed his name to what? Not tricky anymore, but the guy who beat God. That's why modern Israel says, we are Israel. We fight it out. And they were very proud of that name. And from that comes the 12 tribes. And then you're in business. That's what the book of Genesis is. So it's a listing. Do you see that? But before you get to the listing of these humans, you have this, I call it cultural listing. And what is surprising here, let's finish that, and that's why these three are added here, I think. It starts over. Some people call this the genealogy of Cain. It's really from Adam. Some people call this the genealogy of Seth. It really is from Adam. And some people call this one the genealogy of Seth. But it really all comes from Adam. The only reason I think that these three are added, and this may have been a separate tradition, is, as someone said here, to make 10. But the other one is to mention the last. What does the last verse say? Then already in these primeval times, even before the flood, you have the beginning of what other first? Religion. Mm-hmm. Now this is rather surprising. That religion is mentioned among, now this gets to be a little controversial to some people, the cultural achievements of humans. So religion doesn't begin first with Abraham and his descendants when God revealed himself, and then you know they made a covenant. We call that the Old Covenant, that which under which the Jews live. Religion doesn't begin with Jesus and the New Testament. Religion is way back there from the very beginning. Question.
How come that religion didn't continue with Adam and Eve when they were driven out of the garden? After all, they had a relationship with God. They knew God. They had talked to God. And now you're projecting a whole period in there in which there is no religion, but it comes in later on.
No, I wouldn't say that. Your comment assumes that the stories that we had, you know, in chapter 2 and 3, and the story that we had of Cain and Abel, and this story are in the chronological timeline. I wouldn't put a timeline on that. I would respond to what you're saying, though, is that it seems to me, and I can't prove this, that even though Adam and Eve could no longer live in the Garden of Eden, that they, however, did go back, just like Cain and Abel, their descendants, to bring sacrifices and gifts. You see that?
Think they did.
Oh, yes. I think that's assumed there. I might be wrong on that, but I think that's assumed. It seems Cain finally, it goes way east of Eden, and he's so far off, you see, that, well, we had that last time, he may have been defiant, never came back to worship, you see that. And some people will go so far as that when his first son, Enoch, now builds a city, the reason he builds that city is to protect himself from all those people who would take vengeance, you see that. And they'll start war in this section too, and perhaps rightly so. nuclear armaments and all the nightmares that we live with by the fact that now you can make metallurgy, you see that, and you can kill people, you see that, rivals, and you can get rid of them. So the bad side of human achievements are, I'm quite sure, mentioned here. But let's ask you this question. From what I read, did they say, as far as the text is concerned, that it was wrong to be a farmer and to domesticate plants and to raise them like a farmer? No. How about that to build a city? People can interpret it that way, and maybe city life is bad, but I don't know. When I first went from Wisconsin, kind of rural, to where I taught first for 13 years, and I went down near Chicago, and I had a lot of urban students, I thought, well, that's going to be really tough. I found the urban students quite good. They had gone through Chicago and gone through many, many temptations that my rural boys had not, and had gone through in Northwestern College, a Greek theological school. They were largely boys, but they came out the stronger for them. Urban life is such. Division of labor, we talked about that, is all right. And there's nothing, no bad word said about this. There's no bad word said about animal husbandry, putting this on a paying basis, or about this, or this. Except in what is sandwiched in between these two sections, that little section of Lamech's song. Let's look at that. I think that will be worthwhile looking at. That's verses 23 and 24. Can anyone tell me, it's poetry. Can anyone tell me, it's written that way, at least in the RSV, isn't it? When we have poetry in English, it's usually rhyme and rhythm. 30 days past September, April, June, and November, you know. Hebrew has kind of rhymed thoughts. You have one line, and then another line that corresponds with it. Sometimes there's a contrast between the two, and it really teases you to kind of think as you hear it. Now, here, this one isn't so difficult. The first he says, verse 23, he says to his wives, now here comes the poetry, Ada and Silla, hear my voice. You wives of Lamech, hearken to what I say. Saying the same thing, isn't it? Parallel thoughts. So thought rhyme, get the idea? Rhyme of ideas rather than of sounds and accent. Then notice what he says. I have slain a man for wounding me. So in some way, he doesn't tell us why. Some people think that this guy is a rival in love. And the old preachers went at this one, including me, when I was a young man. Now that I'm old, I wouldn't preach that way. In other words, let's say it this way. I think this isn't just a story about Lamech. This is a story about all humans, including Ralph Gehrke. It isn't a story about how things got worse and worse in one family, in one line, the line of Cain. And everybody, you know, that's been the traditional thing. Everybody in the line of Seth was kind of nice. Do you see that? Believers. Some people even say, when it says in chapter 6 before the flood, that the sons of the gods saw the daughters of men and went evil. And they say, well, of course, the sons of the gods were the good guys. And the daughters, I don't know, this was real chauvinism, were all bad. And then they intermarried with them. You see that from the two lines. I don't think you can do that. I think all you have to take this, just the way it stands here, is that just as we are all capable, when we think we've got a bad deal, this is the Cain story, and we think we're suffering injustice of killing people, to see that it's solved that way. So we are capable of taking the swords and all the technological achievements that we have, including nuclear bombs, and if anybody touches us, wounds us, we come here, and this gets worse. A young man, I killed him for striking me. So there was conflict between the two, you see that? But he responded to this affront to his honor by means of a lethal blow that killed him. And then he doesn't stop there. What's the climax of it in verse 24? If Cain is avenged sevenfold, and by the way, this is the divine passive. That means who would avenge the killing of Cain? God. If God will avenge the killing of anyone who touches Cain sevenfold, then he says that your Lamech passive will be avenged sevenfold, but what he really means is that I will avenge myself with this sword, with this nuclear bomb, limitless times. What he's really saying is what? This is an atheist. I don't believe a bit about what it says about Cain and God protecting Cain. Might is right, and if you've got the might, you can do it. And you will do it.
I noticed that Lamech was 77-fold, which is 11 times 7. Is that what 7 come 11?
I think you want double sixes.
You were talking about numbers, and I just thought maybe there was a...
Yeah, well, that is in the case of dice.
Good luck.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in the case of modern dice, I think you're right. I really don't know enough to answer about that myself. I think here in this idea is... You see, he says he's going one farther. Get the idea? By the way, do you know where you have it going farther than that? How many times should I forgive my brother? Yes, and that's right. And do you know that we're going to have one guy, and that's next time, who's going to live 777 years. I'm going to go into all the numbers, not even tomorrow. That's a big study by itself. But I can tell you this much, that all the numbers in chapter 5, and there are all kinds of them. You know, Adam lived 130 years, and he begat Seth. Then he lived, 800 years, and begat sons and daughters. He was a virile old man, and really a powerful. And all the years of Adam were 930 years, and he died. And all those numbers are multiples of their basic number system, 60, except two of them. One for Enoch. Remember, he didn't die. Mm-hmm. His number is
365.
What's that? Come on, you number people. And but not a moon year. A noon year is 355. You got to add 10 more on there. You know, a moon year is wobbly, isn't it? You also have to add intercalendary days. If we had only moon years, didn't have any festivals in between, we'd lose 10 days every year. Well, it wouldn't make so much difference this year, next year, but pretty soon you'd be celebrating Christmas at the 4th of July. You'd miss it. So if you want a solid year, you got to have 365. You really should add a quarter on that, isn't it? A leap year to make that come straight. But that's true. So that one is different to get the message across. See, these numbers have meaning. Get the idea? They're not just IBM statistics. And the other one is this 777. In this case, coming back to your question here, I think that he simply said trillions of times. Get the idea? I'll avenge myself trillions of times. So the possibility that human achievements, cultural achievements, will go off the beam is certainly here. Do you see that? And we know it. Well, let's talk a little about that. What is technology? We talked about the limits to growth. Should we all go back to agrarian society? What is this? Is it good that we have this development is going faster and faster and we can't keep up with it now? Or is it bad?
I wouldn't have it any other way.
You wouldn't have it?
I think it's exciting.
staying the same.
If we just stayed the same for hundreds and hundreds of years, it would be boring.
Boring. All right.
I think my mother, who's 92 years old, and she lived from the horse and buggy to the space age, and now we're going from the space age into this computer age, and I don't know what's called that.
Have you got a ticket to the moon now? Or?
I'd like to.
You'd like to? Okay.
I'm not a teacher.
Just like we find in the vegetable world, we find fruits to eat, we also get fruits that kill. Same as we find good crops, we also find weed. So also in this culture, we have that as good, and we get to try the missile which kills.
That's right.
Parallel between the two. This is the creation of God, good and evil, and everything that we say and do.
Now, these two verses that we're talking about are just a small little story, isn't it? It's kind of an appendix. That's why I'd call this a genealogical listing with little notes about cultural development. You see that? It's kind of an appendix. I think if you wanted to, John, I might rewrite this, you know what I mean? C.S. Lewis might rewrite this for modern society. Yeah, if I had enough the spirit to do it. And tell the whole thing, and also tell the end of it, you know, the Cain and Abel stories. And I can imagine somebody has done it, or will do it, that you'd have it and build it up to take in your considerations and the other. But in embryo, it's saying only one side of it, you see that? What you're saying is that maybe C.S. Lewis, I think, has this in Perelander. At least you can leave the solar system, or at least the Earth, and you get to Mars, and you can start another civilization after they've ruined everything here. and we're talking about this, isn't it? And rather seriously.
I say maybe that's God's way for this population problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
Someday.
Yeah.
You and I aren't going to see it, but it's coming.
Yeah. All right. And especially if we foul our own nest, isn't it?
Yes.
And that we've polluted everything here. Will we do any better in outer space? Ask C.S. Lewis, the baptized imagination. But we need people like C.S. Lewis, don't we?
You bet.
To talk about such things, we absolutely need that. And they must be, as C.S. Lewis has been, grounded in the biblical tradition. And I don't think that this is going to be outdated. It sounds outdated at first, doesn't it? I wonder what's coming off here. But the implications here, I think, are very great. I've thrown out a lot of stuff here. Got to get my licks in early. I'm sorry about that. But I'm a teacher. I'm sorry, I'm mostly undergraduate, so I mishandled them. And if I mishandled you, you have to excuse me. But questions, comments, that's what we need.
Well, way back, Cain left and went east. Picked himself a wife. Obviously, there are a lot of other people on earth, too.
Yes. Where did Cain get his wife from? And how come Cain says that they will slay me? Were there other people around?
Sure.
There are two answers to it. The one isn't a good answer, but I'll give it to you anyway. It jumps on and goes to the next part of chapter 5, and it says, doesn't Adam lived 130 years and begat Seth, and then he lived 800 years, and he begat sons and daughters, and so there were lots of them there. Get the idea? I myself would never put these individual units in Genesis, either the narratives or these genealogies, on a timeline, which you are assuming. Get the idea? And go from one to the other. Therefore, I would suggest that since these are prototypical stories, remember, they're typical of people at the beginning, proto, but also now, that we can't put them on a timeline. They're talking about the times that were beyond the historical memory of ancient Israel, before Abram. That everything started with Abram in their cases, see? They're talking about what we call primeval times. But they're not talking it the way today. Today, if I want to find out about the times before history, and for us history is when you've got written documents, then how do I get at prehistory? Well, if they're human habitations, I have to be an archaeologist, isn't it? And I have to dig it out carefully, and I have to give records. If I want to go beyond what is human, then I defer to you, John, to the geologist, isn't it? And to the paleontologist. And I suppose finally you'd have to go to the Carl Sagan and the astronomers, isn't it? So if you want a scientific answer to that, you will have another model. And just like there are other models of using, looking at our universe than the one in Genesis 1. Remember, so the one in Genesis 1 is a person standing on Earth and seeing the world as we see it. You know, the sky up above, and then the Earth here, and then the water. And that's the way it is. And I think it's a very valid one. Too many people say the only way to look at the sky is to measure it exactly. No, I think it's just as good to see it in a human manner without giving that sort of exactness. So too, to talk about the ancient world in these terms, prototypical terms, you see that? Telling the story of not only the first people, but at the same time, all people since, is a very valid way. I'm going to be provocative here and say, these stories in Genesis 1 to 11, therefore, do not tell us about the events of primeval times just the way they happened. So that we can translate them and put them on a timeline, you see that, and translate them into our terms. But they do tell us precisely of what was really happening in all the things that did happen then. But more than that, all the things that are still happening now, typical of what is now. And as far as I'm concerned, typical of the future, including going on to other worlds. If we can find some other place out there that has enough oxygen and has enough as our planet Earth can be a home for humans. So in that sense, I don't think that we're going to get past, at least people in the Jewish Christian tradition, and I think the rest of mankind too, will not get past the sort of guidelines that you have here in Genesis. This is tremendous. And I think it has given mankind or humankind kind of markings and points of orientation that are extremely important to this day. Am I somewhat responding to your question about where did Cain get his wife? In other words, I think the story simply assumes that there are other people there, you see. It just like assumes that somebody else is going to take blood vengeance on Abel, you see.
Well, actually, they had to start someplace.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so they started with Adam and Eve.
Yes. You see, there had been a time. Let's go back a step farther. There had been times, I was brought up that way, perhaps many of you, where my pastors and my teachers, and they meant well, simply were very insistent that you take all these numbers and in Genesis 5 and add them up with those in Genesis 11, and then finally add them. You used to have it at the tops of the Bibles, and then you could have a chronology of the world. And you had 4,004 is what Bishop Usher, Irish bishop, put down. And usually our modern Bibles do not put that at the top of the Bibles anymore. And it never was even in the original King James. It was just people thought that that's the way it had to be. And people kind of insisted because they were afraid that if you went on to many of these modern ideas, that those would become the viewpoints that you would accept. You see that? And so they kind of insisted that the flood came, I think, about 2300 B.C. And of course, when they found out that the pyramids themselves had been built 2700 B.C., then they had to wonder whether the pyramids had gone through the flood and all kinds of... It took quite a while to get this kind of straightened out. But there are very few people today. I asked my students at PLU, you know, any of you taught 4004 that the world is... 4,000, 6,000 years old, you know what I mean? And you have a few of them that are still taught that. And I can understand it. You see, it was very nice if you would have 2,000 for the history that we have in Genesis 1 to 11, then you had 2,000 for Old Testament, then now we are in 2,000 New Testament. That means 6,000 And when is Judgment Day going to come? In the year 2000, then we'll get to the Sabbath year. You see that? Seven. So you can be sure that all the kooks will come out of the woodwork when we get to the year 2000. Expect that now. Just because the calendar says 2000, that now it's, this is the time. In other words, I don't think that we can continue. In that, I would disagree. And I'm quite sure that people, my students, if they're any good at all, they'll disagree with my opinions, you see that? But that opinion about this, I think, won't wash to put this in a crime line, a timeline.
Of course, actually, it's astounding to me. And every time there's an archaeological finding that indicates a period of time from biblical times, and we're finding more and more of these as we do more archaeological readings in the Middle East, that they can, it coincides with so many of the biblical stories.
Well, yes, I think...
Biblical, because it wasn't written as a chronological book, it was written as a spiritual book.
Yes, it was religious, and it was part of their covenant history, and they made a salvation history, you see that, and all these events. This, what we have been talking about this week, Genesis 1-11 is before Abraham, you see that. You might say their prehistory. And it's told in more general terms than we would imagine, and we have to be a little careful with it. One of the German theologians that I read, his name was Wilhelm Fischer, he's actually French, said if the events of regular history are like grapes, that in order to make wine, you kind of trample them, and then you write your own history. And everybody writes their own history, you know. To write a history, you can tell it, you interpret it. Then these first chapters of Genesis are like the liqueur. See, this is a French, German-French from Alsace writing this, that is taken and made from that wine. You kind of distill that, and then you get... So that these stories are very heavy, you might say, and weighty. That's why it takes a long time to even explicate a very short section of 10 verses here. Partly because we don't use genealogies that way, you see that. All right, any other comments, questions, observations?
We're going to explain about that number 10.
Oh, I guess I never got to that. 10 is because we have 10 fingers. 10 is easy to count. And it got to be one of the main things, you see that? I think, I mean, this is my impression. And I think you'd find that many anthropologists and other people say that. It's a convenient way, you see that, of numbering. And I suppose then you have completeness, so that these genealogies, not only is this one 10, but religion comes as a 10. And I suppose the emphasis here is to be human, is to be religious. What I think is important here, two things. That these Israelites, who are monotheists, they know that Yahweh, the Lord, is the only God that they can trust. You see that? They've made their covenant with Him. And it's, thou shalt have no other gods. You see that? You can't make anything else a god. They know that there were all kinds of gods around them. And they know that there had been gods even before Abram. Abram is a Johnny come lately. He comes in what we call the Middle Bronze Age. There had been a lot of history before that. And they knew that there was a religion, and they say it right here. That already in those early times, before the flood, in those days, men began to call on God. Let's talk about religion a little. Here's a nice description of religion. What kind of religion, what's the essence of religion? We can have sacrifices, we can have oracles, we can have sacred books, you can have temples, you can have all kinds of this, can't you, religion? But what does it say here is kind of the essence, the central thing?
Calling on God.
Mm-hmm. And that's interesting. And are Christians the only ones who pray, or Jews? No, so religion did not begin with Abraham, or Moses, or with Jesus. Religion, and this is a historical fact, that people have been religious. I think the surprising thing here is that this religion is listed among all the cultural achievements of humans. Because we usually, from our perspective as in the Jewish Christian tradition, we look upon religion as a revelation of God, isn't it? God comes to Mount Sinai, he reveals himself, then we respond with the covenant. We have a commitment, you see that? And we either live in faith, trusting God's promises, or we don't. But here you have something even before revelation. So even revelation is, according to this, not an essential of religion. Now, I'm using the word religion. It doesn't use the word religion here. It just simply says what? Calling on the name of God. Well, let's go even farther. What happens to people who are not in our tradition, either the Jewish or the Christian tradition, if they pray, and they do? Does that just go out into thin air? A lady that I know in Gig Harbor, I love her very much, but she says, yes, it does, if you don't pray in Christ. Yeah. Well, wasn't it the head of the Southern Baptist convention that stirred a fuss with everybody by saying, outside of Christ, God doesn't hear prayer? You remember that? There's a lot of trouble inside and outside of his. You remember that? Here, it's obvious that these people are praying, and they knew that people are religious, and I sort of think that's just the fact. Now I'll go even a little step farther, and I'll quote Martin Luther so I'm safe. This is what Martin Luther said. Remember, I told you, you'd be careful with Martin Luther. Don't ever make a saint out of him. I'm glad we commemorate him. But I would hate to have St. Martin Luther in heaven. He would be the worst one. In his commentary on Genesis, he's talking about the Moabites. And he knew, of course, that the Moabites worshipped not Yahweh, but their god is called Chemosh. And he said, when the Moabites worshipped Chemosh, they were worshiping the true God with a false worship. If there is only one God, and it's called here Lord, Yahweh, he really is the real God behind all other realities. Reality, capital R. Then what about the worship, the non-Judeo-Christian worship? Is that valid or not? You see what I'm doing now? I'm really being mad. Luther said, I'll give you it in Latin, Moabitai in caluerum, virum deorum. The Moabites were worshipping the true God, falsu cultu. They didn't do it right, and they didn't have a real understanding. In other words, the one that a Christian should have. But it is there. Well, let's leave Luther aside. St. Paul stands there in Acts 17, the part that Karl Barth, the famous Reformed theologian, said should be out of the New Testament. It doesn't belong there. He was so angry with it. What does St. Paul say when he goes through the marketplace in Athens and sees all the various deities that are worshipped there? And he hears a speech about it. Well, he says, I saw one altar there to the God, the unknown. In other words, they worshipped everything, and they knew that there was a reality beyond that. So they even put an altar there to the unknown. And then he said, but I'm going to tell you about that God, and it's really the only one God, you see that? And who's created everything and through everything. And who finally has shown that history is coming to its climax by raising Jesus from the dead. By that time, the philosophers said, well, we'll hear you tomorrow. they kind of bailed out. But the Apostle Paul says, now watch it. Him whom you worship in ignorance, he calls the worship that these people have a worship of God. He calls it an ignorant worship, you see that?
But then Jesus says, no man cometh unto the Father but by me.
Yes, I think for those who have met Jesus and been confronted Jesus, there's no question about that. For you and me, do you see that? But what I'm saying is that when you are on the other edge and you're not talking to people who are baptized or have commitment to Jesus, either to accept or reject him, and there have been a lot of people like that, then there is religion, you see that? And then you must, and you have to witness. I'm certainly for missions. I'm not one of these people who say missions are should never be done. But I should think that this text here and many others would show us what we have. Carlisle, I'm sorry I didn't stop my line of thought and take your question, but maybe you can give it to us now. Please.
This backs up quite a way. That came through to me, corroborating your perspective on those early chapters. There's a naked anachronism in talking about the worker in bronze and iron. Now, the ancients certainly knew that iron was a very late entry on the scene. And it would be about like saying that the Native Americans were not making their arrowheads and their spearheads of stone, but they were forging metal, and that just didn't happen.
Yes, correct.
I've seen arrowheads that they made out of pieces of whiskey barrels, the hooks. But that was probably this century. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that just corroborates and says the time element here is not of raw antiquity.
That's right. And any assumption in interpreting this that would take its starting point from that time element would not help us understand these stories. These stories will still be meaningful. I think they've always been meaningful. But it won't. Because, well, let's put it in so many terms. The Hittites were the first people, it seems, in that we know historically, that were able to take iron and make it kind of, well, center of their military enterprise and conquer people. And it didn't come down into Israel until about the time of King Saul. Do you remember it says in chapter 1 Samuel, I think it's chapter 14, that it was only Saul and Jonathan that had any equipment that was with iron. They were the only ones. Well, you might remember that Goliath, you remember that famous story of David and Goliath? Goliath had a great log of armor, and it was all bronze, except the 7-pound spear point of his spear. That was 7 pounds. He was a giant to throw 7 pounds. It'd be like a discus thrower. and that was made of what? Iron. That was a nuclear warhead. And here's the David with the stones. You see that? So iron, you're absolutely right, is late. And therefore, if this was a chronology like our old pastors, and I think Luther too, they simply didn't know any different. They simply took those numbers and thought they were chronological numbers. They're not. By the way, if you want the numbers, and some of you are going to leave, all these nice people from Iowa are going to have the final answer. This is wisdom. If you want all those numbers, they finally lead to a target date in Genesis. You can come up here and look at this. Of 4,000. But that is a periodization in proportions, you might say, that go toward the real establishment of the worship of God. It goes back to the establishment of the worship of God at 2,666 years after Adam, which is 2/3 of 4,000. I think you realize that. And it said that after that, they first were in a tent, remember that, the tabernacle?
Yes, thank you.
And then they had 430 years in which they had the temple, but it wasn't very good, and Ezekiel had to lie on his right side and his left side to atone for all the sins that were committed as long as that imperfect worship was there. But they were always waiting to come back to make the second temple. when that would be, these priests were just waiting for that, then the millennium would be here. So it's these numbers are more genealogical numbers, part of a pattern that points to fulfillment. I suppose for us Christians, the real coming of the true worship is what? The coming of Jesus. And therefore, I wouldn't put even that on a chronological line. So I want to understand these numbers the way they were understood by the ancient people. Well, you can see we have a different type of Bible story today. And now comes Judgment Day. So, anyone, anyone else? Goodbye to all the people.